ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adiskin. This is Financial Survival for Wednesday night, the 6th of December, year of our Lord, 2017. James Corbett will be joining us after the first break. In the meantime, I'll give you the market report, a couple of comments, and James should be here in about 15 minutes. New York market, gold is down $3.10 today to $1,263.80. Silver is down 14 cents to $16.02 per ounce. Platinum is down 15 bucks to 904. Palladium is up 10 to 996. And let's see where we are. Let me get my mouse here and scroll down a little bit. U.S. dollar index is currently up 4 cents from today's trade at the New York market. It was up, I don't remember, about 20 cents or about 0.20 in the New York market, but it is at 93.56 right now. Crude oil is up 16 cents to $56.12 per barrel. Dow Jones average was down almost $40 to 24,141. NASDAQ was up 14 to 6,776. New York Stock Exchange was down 35 to 12,532. Standard & Poor's 500 was down 0.3 to 2,629. Having said that, let's see what else we've got to talk about today. Here's something that's interesting to me. There was an article, actually a graphic, and Visual Capitalist is the source. They publish extensive and well-done graphics every workday anyway. And they had one that was entitled, "Can Predictive Data Revolutionize Capital Markets?" And the idea was, can computers, a fundamental idea, they were arguing that computers are becoming increasingly capable of making fairly reliable predictions about what the market will do today, tomorrow, a year from now, and so on. Their capacity to predict is increasing, and the big challenge is big data. There is so much data out there that if the computers can find the right data to follow, they can perhaps make accurate predictions about future investments. But there's so much data out there that it's very difficult to pick the data to follow and separate it from the data that is merely noise. It says here, the good news, there is valuable data out there to help making smart, extremely timely investment decisions. The bad news, there is so much noise that finding valuable data is like looking for a needle in an ever-growing haystack. So how do investors find the signal through the noise? And their answer is predictive data. But before they get into it, they give us a background on what's happening with information. And it is, their observations are disturbing, overwhelming. They make it abundantly clear that you can't really hope to analyze what's going on in the market right now, and most people don't try. Most people currently are speculators. They're not looking for fundamentals, in part because they're lazy, in part because the market is running up and up and up and up, and the only thing they seem to rely on is price. As long as the market is going up, they'll buy into it. If the price is going down, they'll sell out of it. Right? They'll follow the price trends, and that's all for a lot of people who are speculating in the market right now. And this article says big data is a big challenge. What exactly are investors up against? Number one, volume. The creation of data is accelerating so fast that in 2017, this year, there will be more new data in existence than in the last 5,000 years of human history combined. Let me take a drink of water here. maybe that'll clear my throat a little bit. I don't know that this is even true. This is an incredible statement. Maybe it's a misstatement. But they are alleging that there will be more new data created in this year, 2017, than in the last 5,000 years of human history combined, and that includes 2016. Right? If they were going to say there was more new data than in the first 3,000 years of human history, all right, that's not a problem. But they are implying a rate of growth in data that is simply astonishing and beyond the capacity for any man, woman, and child, or even group of men, women, and children to fully assimilate and understand. There are more data, according to this article, more new data. I mean, this is in addition to this. They have created 100%, more than 100% as much new data in this year as they have in the previous 5,000 years. And we can assume that they're going to do the same thing in 2018 and the year after that, and as long as they can hold the system together. Every minute, the U.S. creates 2,657,000 gigabytes of data. Every minute, the United States. We're not talking about Russia. We're not talking about China. We're only talking about the United States. That's equivalent to over 100,000 Blu-ray discs again, and that's per minute. How can it be absorbed? Who can read all this stuff? Who can follow it? Who can understand it? There's a second point they have to deal with when you're dealing with big data. We just talked about volume, which is enormous and beyond human capacity, individual capacity to comprehend. Variety. Data is not uniform. There are many types of data, and they must be processed and interpreted differently. We not only have text data, we have graphics data, sound data, video data. We have data that is structured, semi-structured, quasi-structured, and unstructured. The data that's coming in, it's enormous, but many of us can't even read it. It's there, but what are we going to do with it because of this enormous variety? And then we have velocity. And this is perhaps the most important for people that are trying to invest in the stock market. It says, especially in markets, data needs to be monitored in real time to be useful. Information that's too late might make a trade impossible or mean zero liquidity in a crisis. They're saying that because the velocity of data is moving so quickly, you don't have time to sit back and think about it. If certain data changes, right? You have to sell right now, or you have to buy right now, right now, right now. And it says it has to be monitored in real time to be useful. Insofar as we live in a global economy, some of the data is changing, not just during the eight hours a day when people normally work in New York City selling stocks, bonds, and whatever. Data has to be monitored and reacted to 24/7. Not just 8 hours a day, not just 5 days a week, 24/7, continuously. You can't do it, neither can I. And although they're saying we've got to move to predictive data, that's the conclusion of their article, and they're saying we have to combine all this information, has to be factored into computers, and the computers will tell us what to do. Because this whole thing is moving too fast for you and me. Well, who programs the computers? Who calculates how the computer will treat certain information, and what recommendation will the computer make based on changes in, who knows, a myriad of indices that the computer could follow? Some man or men had to program that computer. And you can't just sit back and say, oh, I'll trust my portfolio to the computer. Because, you know, the computer is not human. It's not influenced by human decisions. And, of course, it is. It's just that the human decisions are the system's analysts who put the computer program together and that decides when you should buy and sell particular stocks, bonds, commodities, whatever. it makes sense that we are going to high-speed computers. And part of the reason for that is because what's happening is beyond human capacity to follow and understand. So we're going to have to put computers together with programs that will tell us what's here. We have a Niagara Falls of information that's coming down on us 24 hours a day. And the computers will sort through every drop of water in that's coming over Niagara Falls, and they will tell us whether to run, hide, invest, sell out, what, stand pat. They'll tell us what to do moment by moment by moment. And we're going to rely on that. If we go to predictive data, if we rely on predictive data, we will rely on machines as if they were oracles, as if they were gods, to tell us whether to invest or not invest. And the lesson in all of this, I mean, they try to cast this problem as something that can be dealt with. But what it really means is that people are incapable of making truly intelligent and fully informed decisions about what's happening in the market at any given moment. And the people who come out and say, well, I'm an investment guru, and you should buy this or you should sell that, they can't tell that. That even if they tell you what was true a half hour ago, whether you should buy or sell, the data is moving so rapidly in such an incredible volume that it might have been true a half hour ago that you should buy a particular stock, but here we are 30 minutes later, and in the midst of this Niagara of data, it's no longer true. Half hour ago, yeah, sure, it was smart a half hour ago to buy a particular stock, but now you got to sell. There are problems here that ultimately tell us that the market is no longer friendly to people. It's no longer something we can use our own expertise. It used to be that if you were an investor, you would go study the stock and you would study the corporation or the particular investment that you wanted to put your money into. You'd study it. You'd learn it. Nowadays, only thing anyone seems to be following is price. We are operating on the assumption that if the market is moving up, the market must know what it's doing. I don't know what it's doing. You don't know what it's doing. No one else knows what it's doing. But we are operating on the assumption that the market is moving collectively as some sort of a giant intelligence, and it filters out all the truth and all the facts and all the information, and the market will tell us the correct price. That is the presumption. I don't think that presumption is reliable. I don't think the market, ultimately, the collection of all the people who are investing, I don't think they know for a fact what's going on. The only thing the market is measuring right now is group psychology. Are we optimistic? We buy. Are we pessimistic? We sell. That's it. Beyond that, it doesn't matter what's the price of crude oil. No one cares. Well, what's that got to do with the price of IBM or General Motors or Standard Oil? All we need to do is look at the price, and it's a dangerous presumption, and it shows us that something's happening technologically with the markets that is hard for us to understand. It is making the markets incomprehensible. And if you can't comprehend what's going on, how can you safely invest? You can ignorantly invest, but I don't see how you can safely invest. And it simply points that we're going to come to a time when we're going to find out that everybody does not know what's going on, and the price is not a valid indicator of what the value of a stock should be, of a particular stock or other investment should be. And there's going to be a massive correction one of these days. Got another comment here from TechLunch. Parity CEO, or TechCrunch, excuse me. Parity CEO is confident that $150 million in frozen Ethereum isn't lost forever. Parity Technology is a corporation. Earlier this year, Parity Technology seemingly lost about $150 million worth of Ethereum when a user of its wallet, this accidentally deleted a code library that made Parity's wallets work. Now, all by itself, that's an extraordinary statement. $150 million has disappeared because a user, not one of the supervisors, not one of the administrators, but just somebody who calls in essentially over the internet. He did something that caused a code library to disappear, to be deleted. And as a result, $150 million worth of Ethereum was disappeared. It says at least 1 million Ethereum became frozen, and about 90 million of those were actually from Parity co-founder and Ethereum core developer Gavin Woods' token sale for its Polkadot blockchain technology, whatever that is. The money may not be lost forever, though. Well, there's something that inspire you to get some more Bitcoin. People just lost $150 million in Bitcoin and or cryptocurrencies, other cryptocurrencies, Ethereum in any case. But they say the money may not be lost forever. This is like something magical. This is something like mythical. It's like something pulling out a magic wand and pointing it at someone or something and simply making them disappear. They're gone. It's gone. Like that. It didn't disappear over a period of 30 minutes or an hour or a day or something. It was gone in a heartbeat, and probably much less than a heartbeat. It's the sort of story that you hear repeatedly about our brave new world of cryptocurrencies. Our brave new world of internet identity that's being stolen on a regular basis. Our brave new world of internet use of credit cards, debit cards. Hackers are getting in, they get access to your credit card, your debit card, next thing you know, you're being wiped out. There is something happening in our electronic, our digital infrastructure that does not inspire confidence. And sooner or later, there's going to be, it's not just $150 million that will simply disappear and vaporize in a blink of an eye. It'll be the whole system's going to go down, and it'll happen one of these days. And when it does, it will change people's attitude, and they are suddenly going to be aware that, uh-oh, this stuff is dangerous. It's not reliable. It's not a place to store your wealth. It may be a place to gamble and make place your bet, but it's not a good place to place your wealth. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials, and when we return, James Corbett should be calling in from Japan. He's the author of The Corbett Report, and he should be joining us shortly. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. My guest is James. Oh, my God, I'm getting old to the point where I can't hardly remember things like Corbett. Anymore. It's not exactly a senior moment, because a senior moment, I think, lasts a little longer, but we do have these little moments. We do have these little interludes when I wind up groping for especially names. I'm getting to the point where I may not remember my own name one of these days. Got an article here from Breitbart News, and the headline is Trump, quote, "I have determined that it's time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel." What's going on here, James? Is he looking for trouble? Are he and Israel looking to revive the war in the Middle East? It seems to be dying in Syria and so on. Are they trying to make trouble, or do they think they have so much power right now they can get away with this? And is it dangerous, or is it just PR? Is this a significant change, or is it much ado about nothing?
Well, I truly can't come up with an explanation or interpretation of this that is anything other than stirring the pot. I mean, this is a gigantic finger in the eye of every player in the Middle East, except for Israel and its closest, staunchest allies. And there's no geopolitical explanation for this, why this had to be done right now, or, you know, what greater good this is going to serve. And I don't think there's even particularly a greater good being served narrative that's being pumped along with this. It's just, well, it's time, you know, might as well acknowledge it now. I can't even comprehend this. Even if you were an Israeli firster, Jewish supremacist, whatever, I can't understand why this would be a politically viable or laudable move in any sense. So I mean, this is just clearly, I think, pandering to the Israel lobby and certain evangelical crowd in the U.S. electorate. I guess that's the only political interpretation I can come on with this. And yes, I think it's going to have ramifications, because obviously this is going to further stoke and inflame tensions in the Middle East. There's no way that this is not going to have political ramifications.
Where do you think the ramifications will be most powerful? We're going to worry about Syria? We're going to worry about Saudi Arabia? I don't think Saudi Arabia is concerned about this. What about Iran? Is this going to draw Iran and force them to do something?
Well, I think that has to be one of the ramifications of this, one of the consequences. I mean, right on Israel's doorstep, of course, you have Hezbollah with Lebanon, and all of the craziness playing out there between Lebanon and Saudi Arabia right now has to do with Saudi Arabia and its growing relationship with Israel. So, for example, you get the Daily Star out of Beirut with its front page story. No offense, Mr. President, Jerusalem is the capital of Palestine, and it's a big front, full page story. And this is the way this is going to be seen and interpreted by certainly Lebanon. Certainly Iran has to be looking at this. And Also, I mean, a related story of sorts, back on the 1st of December, Israel was launching airstrikes against Syria, a supposed alleged military base out on the outskirts of Damascus or outside of Damascus, that supposedly, allegedly, according to a BBC anonymous source that won't go on the record, it was being used to house some sort of Iranian military presence in Syria. So Israel bombed it to smithereens. These kinds of major moves are happening right now, and in the middle of this, you have the supposed arbiter of the Israel-Palestine dispute, the U.S., the country that is supposedly arbitrating this dispute, coming in and unilaterally deciding, okay, let's completely change the diplomatic status quo here for no well-defined reason. That's insanity. It's geopolitical insanity. And the Iranians have to read the writing on the wall and have to know that, I mean, there is no doubt that there has... The U.S.-Israel relationship has always been very close, but probably has never been closer than what it is represented here with the Trump administration. And that can only mean green light, go ahead for some attack on Iran at some point. Or that seems to be the game plan that's coming into view. And that, I mean, Iran has to be reading the writing on the wall with this.
There are people in the United States...
Sorry, I should say, I don't want to exclude the Palestinian people from this discussion, because obviously that is where this affects right at home. This is issue number one, but I'm just saying the larger geopolitical ramifications of this. Ultimately, Iran has to be looking at this.
There are people in the United States who believe, they conspiracy theorists who believe, that Israel controls Congress, and they are passing laws all the time, not just because we like Israel, but because we're ordered by Israel to pass these laws. But there are also people in Israel who believe that the Israeli government is the servant of the U.S. government, and they're complaining that their government is being run by ours. Which government is running the United States? Which government is running Israel? How close is the relationship? Just one of a kind of, I don't know, mutual admiration, and I'm not even sure that that's, you can say that anybody admires anyone in this situation, but is there real control, or is there merely persuasion and influence?
Yeah, which tail is wagging which dog?
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
It's a good question, because I think the way to look at this, I think, isn't in terms of the nation state idea that we've been presented with. It isn't about that. It's about,
I agree with you,
the United States is the world's monetary and military superpower, and it is 100% committed to Israel in the Middle East region, and with all that entails, including the billions and billions of dollars of aid directly and explicitly, but also everything else, covering up diplomatically at the UN, vetoing every resolution or every sanction against Israel for its illegal settlements and things like this, or the nuclear ambiguity, the official policy of the United States not to acknowledge the fact that Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons, undeclared nuclear weapons, and is not part of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, making it a rogue state. All of these things have to be seen as a package deal. This isn't the U.S. is wagging the Israel tail, or the Israel tail is wagging the U.S. dog. It's that they are, in a sense, the oligarchs that control this are one and the same and part of the same clique, and are obviously looking out for each other. So clearly, the Israel lobby in the U.S. and its power over Congress is, I think, indisputable, and is not even really disputed by the people who advocate it for it. They just say that well, that's a good thing, because Israel is our friend. And on the flip side of that, Israel wouldn't be able to do what it does in the Middle East without that U.S. support and backing and aid and everything else that comes along with it. So it's a package deal, and clearly that package isn't being untied or unwound by the drain the swamp Trumper. This is 100% going full forward with this relationship, and that has to be worrying, because we know on the record, admittedly, the Israeli long-term game plan is the greater Israel project, is what it's been referred to, which is to destabilize its bordering nations and neighboring nations like like Syria, has been specifically targeted by things like the Oded Yunon plan. We have to destabilize it. We have to get the sectarian violence going in these Arab states and other bordering nations, and as a way of furthering Israeli interests in the region. And ultimately, it goes back to the Brookings Institute and all these other think tanks in the U.S., but of course they have Israeli friendly people working for them who are also thinking about things like which path to Persia. Look that up. That's a document about how, basically, what's the best way to start the war with Iran. And that is on the game plan. That is in the cards. It's a long-term thing, and that's one of those things that I hate to come back to this so often, but it really is one of those things where that is a line in the sand. There's no going back. You can start some sort of thing in Syria and try it as a proxy war with forces fighting and what have you, but if you cross the line with Iran, that really does cross the fundamental line and now brings in the wrath of Russia and China and all of this. So I just don't like the way this is going.
It seems incomprehensible. It just seems unwise. Somebody's got to have an ulterior motive in here, because they can't be that dumb. I mean, this is not something that challenges the average person's intelligence. You got to see this is going to be trouble. I'm wondering about, because do you think this has anything going after Iran? Saudi Arabia apparently wants to do that under any circumstances. They have a visceral dislike, and I believe they've got one of them Sunni and the other one is Shiite. Does this have anything to do with reports that Iran has been supplying North Korea with weapons? In the context of the North Korean conflict, is somebody saying we got to shut Iran down?
Right, yeah. Well, I would say those reports are probably more about being aimed against Iran than they are at North Korea. In fact, I was listening to an interesting interview, and I can't remember the citation at this point, so it's unfortunate. I believe it was on the Scott Horton show. One of his guests was talking about how the speechwriter for the infamous Axis of Evil speech during the Bush administration, David Frum, I believe, a Canadian, came up with that phrase, that idea, or supposedly did, at least wrote the speech, which ultimately became the Axis of Evil speech. And now we know, North Korea and Iran and Iraq were the Axis of Evil back there in 2002. And, well, we took care of Iraq, so now it's time to get the other two. The original idea for that speech, of course, did not originate with David Frum. It was from, I believe, Richard Perle, was what this guest was talking about, and this is documented by various people. Richard Perle, of course, being one of the neocons in the Bush cabal. And the original Axis of Evil idea was, of course, not Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. I mean, there's no even conceivable connection with that, and it doesn't make sense geopolitically, economically, in any way. Why throw in North Korea? It's so that it wasn't the original Axis of Evil, which was going to be Iran, Iraq, Syria, which is, hello, it's quite obvious. That is Israeli foreign policy. That is not U.S. That couldn't even remotely consider that as U.S. foreign policy. That is Israeli foreign policy. So they threw in North Korea as kind of the canard. Look, it's not about Israel. It's about general U.S. foreign policy. And that, I think, so now we see the North Korean conflict being used as another way of trying to tie in essentially this. What I've talked about on my program recently is the resistance bloc, however you want to form it, that's forming in opposition to the axis that formed around the takedown of Assad in Syria, where you had Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the U.S. and Israel and Turkey all jumping in to feed the flames and to fund and train and arm these terrorist insurgents, and to even provide them in the case of Saudi and some of the other countries. That was the formation of some sort of, I don't know, Middle Eastern axis, whatever you want to call it. And in opposition to that, we have seen Lebanon and Iran and Syria and to some extent Iraq, and now even by proxy China and Russia all being, if at any rate, thrown into each other's arms. I mean, they are actually collaborating and sharing intelligence now where they weren't before. So there is a formation of a kind of resistance bloc here. And North Korea is going to be one of those things where, hey, everybody, look, there's a crazy guy over there doing crazy stuff, and he's tied to Iran, which is tied into Lebanon, which is tied into everything else. So it just becomes a convenient way of moving the chess pieces into whatever part of the board they want.
Is the creation of this bloc, the BRICS, as much as anything, there is more to it than just the BRICS, but is the creation of this block an accident, an unintended consequence of American meddling in foreign affairs, or did the people in government say, we need a new and convincing threat, a group of nations that we can point to and say, oh my gosh, do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I think you expressed it best just a few minutes ago where you said, well, they can't be this dumb. And yep. I think that's exactly the case with this. There is absolutely no way that the foreign policy planners and the think tankers and the people who do this for a living are suddenly taken by surprise. Oh, wow. So you mean when you delist Iran from the SWIFT network and you put on these sanctions on mm-hmm. on Russia and China and all of this, suddenly they're driven into each other's arms and start forming this geopolitical bloc against us? I never would have predicted. No, of course. This is, of course, a perfectly predictable result and conclusion from the premises that we've been given. And the only question is, so what does that mean? Either it means they just don't care. I mean, it's just such a non-issue that there's this resistance block of some sort forming against them. Or that was the plan all along, in fact, that to create the opposition. And I think that is ultimately my take on this. And in the BRIC case specifically, literally, factually, the term BRIC was invented by Goldman Sachs. It comes from a Goldman Sachs white paper back in, I believe, 2001, written by Goldman Sachs chief economist, who said, hey, look, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, these are the emerging economies. They're expected to have such and such a share of global economic growth over the next decade. They have this kind of thing in common. They should be treated as a bloc. And they looked at that paper and said, okay, let's do it. So it literally comes from Goldman Sachs. This is completely on the cards. There's no way that foreign policy planners didn't see it. And I think this has been the concerted effort to create the narrative, the force, the boogeyman of the 21st century.
If we create that boogeyman, how does this affect the New World Order? I'm looking at the New World Order as they want to combine everyone together and get a single unified system. If they are creating an alternative system or allowing an alternative system to establish itself, does that threaten the New World Order, or is that a device by the New World Order to create a boogeyman that can be smashed down, and in the context of that smashing, we can create a single unified global government?
I think that is one of the ways that this can unfold. Another way is to keep the world in some sort of perpetual warfare or some sort of state like that, because the Cold War era was an era of essentially, it was globalization into two competing camps, and you had the third world, which was the non-aligned world, that didn't quite fit in those cracks conveniently, but at any rate, the majority of the developed world was in one camp or another, and I think that might be part of the endgame of this. Perhaps the idea of a single unitary system is not sustainable. They know that you need some sort of conflict, you need something in there to keep the two sides buttressing each other, essentially, which is exactly how the two-party system works in the United States, for example. The Republicans and Democrats buttress each other. There can be no viable third alternative because the two-party system is so entrenched, and that might be the vision of politics in the future. A vision that was laid out as early as 1993, back when Samuel P. Huntington published The Clash of Civilizations in Foreign Affairs and then developed that into his 1996 book, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, talking about how the 21st century is going to be defined by this clash of Western and Islamic civilization. And lo and behold, here we are.
I don't know. We'll have to talk about this after the break. We'll take a couple of commercials, and I'll be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. And we'll learn more about the clash of civilizations. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every heart is
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Financial survival. We were talking about the clash of civilizations. I'm sure you're aware that China is assembling, is putting together the means of purchasing crude oil from other countries, paying for it with yuan, and backing the payment with gold, where if they want to take their yuan and trade it in for gold, they can do that. This is not simply a matter of convenience. This is one of the reactions that we can expect from the BRICS, for example, because of the United States government's attempts to regulate and manipulate foreign countries. They are reacting, and they're saying we don't want any part of it, and they are attacking the petrodollar. And here's an article from Russia to Insider. The headline is, "A Goodbye Petrodollar, Russia Plans a First Ever Sale of Yuan Bonds." Okay, that's one thing that we know about. But Venezuela came out just lately, just this week, and announced that they were going to create a cryptocurrency that would be backed by crude oil and a couple other crude oil, natural gas, if I understand correctly, liquid natural gas, and gold. This is a second country, and in Venezuela, is not as Venezuela goes, it's not true that as they go, so goes the world. But just the same, this is a second country coming up with a currency alternative that involves gold at least and crude oil and tries to get away from the U.S. dollar. Is this a coincidence or is this an idea whose time has come?
Yes, well, it's at any rate a necessary move from the point of view of countries that have found themselves in the crosshairs of the U.S. empire. And I don't think they have a choice. Whether it's going to work or not, or what will come of it, no one can say. But at any rate, I don't think they have a lot of choice when it comes to this. And Venezuela, of course, in a particularly perilous economic situation, so they're throwing things at the wall and seeing what will stick. I don't think that's particularly surprising. Just to play, if not play the devil's advocate, at least put this petro yuan in perspective. There is an interesting and thought-provoking post on Bloomberg, and I know my audience is going to bristle at the idea of those words going together, but at any rate, Bloomberg has a good post up on China's push to trade oil in yuan faces a key hurdle, and it talks about how Let's not talk about this as if it's a done deal already and everything's already in place and this is the new petro yuan and here it is. No, this is still something that's developing and could develop in the future. But to put it in perspective, the actual international energy exchange on which people are supposedly in the near future going to be doing oil futures trading priced in yuan is still pending. In fact, the first test trades are scheduled to begin this weekend. So it's still not even actually functioning. And even after it is actually functioning, it's still a considerable way to go from that to actually having viable real markets working in the yuan, because people are obviously very hesitant, and I think rightly so, to start doing a great amount of trade in yuan when there are such heavy capital restrictions and capital controls by the Chinese government, and the Chinese government pegs to the dollar anyway, so, or it has a free floating peg or whatever they call it. But at any rate, it is tied to the US dollar, as is most of the currencies in the Middle East, where the key is. If the countries in the Middle East start trading in petro yuan, that's something significant, but most of their currencies are tied to the dollar anyway. The vast majority of world transactions are in dollars. Most of the markets by volume is in the U.S. Just everything is centered around and constructed around the U.S. dollar system. That's not going to change easily, and it's certainly not going to change overnight. The petro yuan is at least a potential possibility now, but it's still a long way to go, at least, and not necessarily a long way in time, because no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, but at any rate, there's still a lot of things that would have to change in order for the yuan to really function as a replacement for the petrodollar. So I don't think this is a near-term thing we're talking about. It's just the potential that people are looking at right now, and that's really the important part of this. As you say, people are seeing the handwriting on the wall, whether it's the Chinese, whether it's the Venezuelans, whether it's a number of other countries that are thirsting for a way off the U.S. dollar grid that exists right now. But that's, I don't think most people have a conception of just how pervasive that grid is in the financial and economic world that underlies all international transactions. At this point, there is no alternative to the U.S. dollar fundamentally. We're only seeing the beginnings of the creation of something that could become a real competitor to the dollar.
The axis of evil. If I understand correctly, the original countries that were declared to be components of the axis of evil, they had one common denominator. They didn't have any central banks that were dominated by the Rothschilds, and they did not rely on the U.S. dollar. One of the first things we did after we invaded Iraq, they had is we flew in pallet loads of $100 bills and moved Iraq away from the Iraqi currency, which had been backed by gold, if I understand correctly, and into the fiat currency of U.S. dollars. And is that the reason we invade? Is that what the axis of evil is all about? If you don't use U.S. dollars, are you deemed to be evil?
Yes. I mean, in a word, yes. And, of course, that was part of what happened with Iraq and Hussein, who had started trading, who had started an oil burst denominated in euros rather than dollars. And, in fact, I just dug it up recently for a recent episode of my Questions for Corbett series. I'll have to look up the reference again. But The Guardian had an article. It was in, I believe, February of 2002, something like that, or 2003, I should say, right before the bombs started falling. That was something to the effect of, you know, that crazy weird man Saddam Hussein has started pricing his oil in euros instead of dollars. What's he thinking? Why is he scared of the Americans or whatever? And of course, I mean, in retrospect, it's so obvious exactly what he was doing and why he was targeted and all of that. But I mean, that's a part of it. Absolutely, that's a part of it. And it's something I pointed out a lot at the time, and I will continue to point out. One of the first things that these rebels did in Libya when they were overthrowing the oppressive tyrant Gaddafi, one of the very first things on their agenda for some reason was setting up a new central bank. I wonder why, you know, what's the point of that? Oh, it's because that is fundamentally what so much of this is about. And now we don't have to speculate about that. We even have from Hillary's emails, the email about how, yeah, the French were pretty mad at Libya for wanting to start this gold dinar idea and make a new African currency that's gold-centered rather than, you know, using the French colonial leftovers and relying so much on France, and that was part of the calculation that went into the Libyan overthrow. So it certainly is. If there is a threat to American dollar hegemon, that will be met with military force.
And which means that anyone who tries to fool around with this, I mean, I look at I'm inclined to view China's creation of a petro yuan, that is additionally indirectly backed by gold, I see this as sufficient reason to go to war. From the perspective of the government of the United States, assuming that this can catch fire and gain traction quickly, it might be the single biggest threat to the United States since maybe the communist, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So I see this as dangerous, and we see Venezuela coming out as they want to back their currency by get away from fiat. They're going to back their currency by crude oil, which they have a lot of, and also gold, which they don't have much, but some.
And diamonds, I heard.
All right, diamonds, yeah. But they're giving us a currency that's backed by something tangible, even if it's corn cobs. Okay, we have a new corn cob currency out here. It's technically superior to a fiat dollar. You can redeem your new corn cob currency in corn cobs. Can't redeem the U.S. dollar in anything, at least not from the Federal Reserve and or the government of the United States. The way you redeem the U.S. dollar right now, especially if you're in a foreign country, is you take the dollars to the United States and you buy things like land and homes and buildings and businesses and whatever else from private citizens. The private people of the United States of America are the ones that are redeeming the paper dollars that are being issued by the government and or the Federal Reserve. It's like me requiring you to make good on the checks I'm using to buy a new car, a new house, whatever. As long as you're the one who's held responsible, I can buy anything. So, I don't know. The world is changing, and on top of all of what we see, or what we're beginning to see in the possibility of currencies that are not pure fiat, now we have Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies.
Yes, and I think the fundamental thing that we should be keeping in mind with this whole conversation that we're being plunged into, whether we know it or not, is that this raises the fundamental point that I've been talking about for years and years and years at the Corporate Report that I think is more apt now than ever and will be even more apt a few years from now, is the fundamental underlying point of this is that the economy, what really is the economy, what really drives economic productivity is the people and people transacting with each other. That is the real heart and the lifeblood of the economy. And that's implicit in these fiat systems where theoretically the way that what the dollar is really backed by is essentially, well, it's the IRS has the gun to your head and we'll be able to claw back a part of that. That's what underlies it. The tax isn't actually used to pay down the debt, of course, as we know. It's used to secure that debt. Look, we have this tax base that the tax cattle that we can milk, and that's what it is. But ultimately what that is saying we have a portion of all of this labor that's going on in the economy. That's what backs the dollar. That is the lifeblood of the dollar system. And we are just the monopolists on top of that, and we tell you have to pay your tribute to us in these dollars, so everyone needs the dollars. But once, if we can break that fundamental shackle and realize that transactions between individuals, between people, is really the lifeblood of the economy, and we create the value of any monetary system, that opens up all sorts of possibilities, including the cryptocurrency world and everything else. But as long as we're stuck in that fiat mentality where the money is just something that's created by the government and that's the government gives it its value. No, we give money its value. Until we realize that, we'll never be able to take the power back.
You talk about the economy. Are you talking about the economy of the United States, or are you talking about the economy of the world? And the reason that's important is you talked about people are key to what the economy does, essentially. Are we only talking about the American people right now? Are we talking about the people of the world in relation to the global economy? And the reason I ask that is I would say the people of the world are probably a little more eager than the people of the United States to get rid of the fiat dollar.
Yes. Well, you're right. I mean, different people in different political and economic circumstances will have their different views on this. And obviously, places like Venezuela are casting about for anything much more drastically and dramatically than people in the United States right now. But you're right to point out the distinctions because the economy and economics are just such I mean, such loaded and phrases with so much baggage right now that it's difficult to even know what that does mean. I should, if I was speaking carefully, would say catalaxy and catalactics rather than economy and economics. And the idea being that our language has been so perverted that economy, it comes from the old Greek term about household management, which is the analogy, the metaphor upon which our conception of the economy is based. It's like managing a household. And so the U.S. government manages the U.S. economy, which is this household, as it were, that they manage. And it's something that has to be ordered towards a certain end. That is the wrong, fundamentally wrong way of looking at it. It's the wrong metaphor that gets us thinking in the wrong direction. Because there is not a single household with a single leader that's going towards a single goal. It's millions or hundreds of millions, or in the global situation, billions of people that are all going about their own business and seeking their own ends and going and trying to find the best way through life. And there is no single system for everyone. There is no single way that they should all be going, and some single person who can oversee all of that. And because we have been tricked into thinking of economy and economics instead of catalaxy and catalactics and free exchange between free people, we start thinking the wrong way, we start using the wrong terms, we start complicating things that do not need to be complicated. When I was speaking about the economy there, I was talking about interactions and transactions between free human beings. And that we don't have a convenient word for that, which is interesting, because that is ultimately what this is all about, any monetary system should be aiming towards, just greasing the skids for people to interact and transact with each other.
Well, that's an interesting theory, but it seems to me what the monetary system is really interested in is robbing people. I mean, if we're going to put up a new world order and a new system and new money or new currencies, cryptocurrencies, whatever, does that mean that everybody's going to get a fair shake, or does it mean that some people are going to enjoy an enormous advantage and the others are going to be impoverished?
Yes. Well, if status quo continues and if people don't understand what's happening, then yes, they will be fleeced, as they are in every generation, no matter what technology is behind it. If people understand what is happening and take control of that, I think there is a way to steer it in the direction that's beneficial for humanity. But it's always about the understanding, whether people know what's happening and how, what they should be doing and why they should be doing it. And that's one hell of a long road to walk.
I agree. And it's going to be not only a hell of a long road to walk, it'll be a big job just repairing the potholes in that road, because there's lots of them. We're out of time, James. Thank you for being on the program. It's James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks. We're out of time. Thanks for listening, folks. And be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd, the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.